It gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker, Charles Kupchan, who is here to give us a talk today on After Pax Americana, No One's World. He is Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown and the Whitney H. Shepherdson Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Professor Kupchan was Director of European Studies, for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the first Clinton administration. Before joining the NSC, he worked in the U.S. Department of State on the policy planning staff. Prior to government service, he was Assistant Professor of Politics at Princeton. He's the author of numerous books, a few of which I'll just mention here. The most recent is called No One's World, The West, The Rising Rest, and The Coming Global Turn, which was published in 2012, which will be, I suspect, at the heart of his discussion today. He is also the author of How Enemies Became Friends, or Become Friends, The Source of Stable Peace, published in 2010. The End of the American Era, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Geopolitics of the 21st Century, published in 2002. And in addition to other books, of course, countless articles and essays dealing with strategic affairs, international politics. Professor Kupchan received a BA from Harvard University and the MPhil and DPhil from Oxford. He has served as a visiting scholar at numerous institutions all over the world, in London, in Paris, in Tokyo. During 2006-07, he was the Henry Kissinger Scholar at the Library of Congress and was a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Please join me, ladies and gentlemen, in welcoming Professor Charles Kupchan.
Thank you very much, Fred, for the warm welcome. It's a pleasure for me to be back in Ithaca. I think that there aren't a lot of folks out there that you could convince to come to Ithaca in the middle of February, witness what's going on outside the window there. But as someone born and raised in Wisconsin, I'm always happy to have an Arctic blast. So I actually enjoy this kind of weather. I'm also very happy to be back to see some of my friends in the government department and also some friends in the history department and also some new friends in the history department. As my social scientific colleagues know, it sometimes is the most interesting to have seminars that span disciplinary boundaries, so I'm delighted to be here at the invitation of a historian. Yet I'm also somewhat intimidated because when political scientists speak among themselves, we play fast and furious with the facts. We make things up. As long as our arguments are reasonably convincing and reasonably persuasive, that's good enough. But when you've got historians around, they can take you to the mat. I'm going to have to tread lightly because I'm going to go through some history in the talk today, but I hope the historians will give me some wide berth when I do. The only regret that I have in visiting today is that my friend John Kirshner is not here. He's apparently at Princeton for the semester, and that means that I will probably go through my visit without having long discussions about films of the United States and great American singers, but most importantly, I will not have two bottles of Chateau Neuf de Pop from the Kirshner cellar. But that does mean, frankly, Fred, that you have some slack to pick up tonight, and I'll hold you to that. Despite my comments about the dangers of treading into historical material for a political scientist, I'm going to start with some history. If we were in 1700 and we gathered here, this room, my guess, was not here, but we could nonetheless gather and have a conversation somewhat similar to the conversation that we will have today about the world, global politics, the distribution of power, how the world works. I think we would come up with the following assessment. If we had the facts, and in fact, in the year 1700, people didn't know a whole lot about what the world looked like thousands of miles away from where they were. But knowing what we know now about the world in 1700, we would have seen that roughly half of global wealth was held by two Asian countries, India and the Qing Dynasty in China. We would find that in 1700, there were three other main centers of power in the world. To the east of China was the Tokugawa Shogunate in Japan. To the west of the Mughal Empire and what is today India was the Ottoman Empire. And then to the west of the Ottomans was a somewhat more loosely configured and loosely articulated polity, because I think empire is the wrong word, in Europe, centered around the Habsburg family, the Holy Roman Empire, consisting of a kind of governance much less centralized and much less formalized than what one saw in the Ottomans, the Mughals, the Qing, or in the Tokugawa Shogunate. So you had those two big empires representing about half of global wealth, and then those other three players. In other words, the year the 1700 was home to a broadly multipolar distribution of power. If we gathered again about 100 years later, or let's say 115 years later, because 1815 is a nice date in history since it marks the end of the Napoleonic Wars and the beginning of the Concert of Europe, we would have found that the world had changed quite dramatically over the previous 100 years, and that power had shifted quickly and dramatically from Asia to the north and to the west. And by 1815, when the Napoleonic Wars ended and the Industrial Revolution was in full swing in England and starting to spread, make its way through the continent, Europe had gone from a backwater in the early modern period to being the globe's leading center of economic and military strength by the 19th century. And by the end of the 19th century, 90%, almost 90% of the world's landmass was either a European colony or a former European colony. And so the world changed quite dramatically over the period between 1700 and 1815. Europe sprinted ahead of the rest of the world. The global balance of power swung quickly and broadly to the north and to the west. What I'm going to argue this afternoon is that we are starting to enter a period that is going to look a little bit like the 1700s, when the pendulum swung, when the globe's center of gravity moved. And the long period of history that we entered in 1815 is, I think, going to come to a close over the next few decades. And that period, that long 200-year run of Western hegemony, first under Pax Britannica and then under Pax Americana, will give way to something else. And the question is, what will that something else be? And my answer to that question is that it will be no one's world. It will be a world that for the first time in history will be globalized, it will be interdependent, we will be, to use a technical term, smooshed together in ways we've never been before, but we will be smooshed together, no longer anchored by Western hegemony. And I do think that one can talk about Pax Britannica and Pax Americana as a peace, even though there were significant differences between British hegemony and American hegemony. They were also predicated upon a certain set of common values, political orientations, and socioeconomic foundations. That long run, however, in which Anglo-Saxon countries have anchored the global system is giving way to a world in which the globe's center of gravity is again shifting as it did between 1700 and 1800. The main difference between the world that we emerged into in the 19th century and the world that we will emerge into in the 21st century is that it will no longer be under the guardianship of the West. It won't be an Asian century. It won't be a Chinese century. It won't be an American century. The next century, this century, will not belong to anyone. That's the main argument that I'm going to make this afternoon. Let me take the next 20 minutes or so to put some flesh on the bones, spell out the different components of that argument, and then I'll take the last 10 minutes or so to offer some reflections on what we Americans should do about a world in which this long run of Western hegemony appears to be coming to an end. The material side of the analysis is, in my mind, not particularly contestable nor particularly interesting. And by that I mean we know from history that the globe's center of gravity moves during particular moments in history. And we know that we are entering one of those periods of history because the numbers don't lie. And what the numbers tell us is that we have gone from roughly a world in which the West collectively represented 75% of global GDP, that would be its height, its peak in the Cold War, to a world today in which the West collectively represents a bit short of 50% of global GDP. And over the next couple of decades, we will go to a world in which the West's share of global GDP continues to decline to about 40%. The IMF, World Bank, Goldman Sachs studies that I drew on to sort of map out how quickly and profoundly this world will change suggest that Chinese aggregate GDP will catch up with the aggregate GDP of the United States sometime around 2027, 2028 to 2030. They predict that within 10 years, we will live in a multi-currency world. The dollar, the renminbi, and the euro, three roughly equal reserve currencies. Today, of the top five economies in the world, four of them still come from the developed West. Only one non-Western country makes the cut. That's China. It comes in at number two. Its GDP is still about half of ours. If you fast forward 30 to 40 years, that pecking order completely reverses. Of the top five economies in the world, only one will be from the developed West. That will be us. We will come in at number two, and our economy will be roughly half the size of China's. And numbers three, four, and five will all come from what is today the developing world. Goldman Sachs predicts that the tipping point when the BRICS, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, catch up with and surpass today's industrial world is 2032. Not that far away. Now, should we put great stock in those numbers? Do we think that those predictions will be correct? Absolutely not. We know that they will be wrong. How do we know that? Because they're always wrong. China may grow more slowly than we expected, and India may grow more quickly than we expected. But in the aggregate, the picture that data portrays is, in my mind, quite conclusive. And that is that we are entering a period in which the globe's center of gravity is shifting. What I think is more interesting and what I want to spend more time talking about is what will that shift in the globe's center of gravity mean for the way the world works, for how the world functions, for the rules-based order that we have been living in since the onset of Pax Americana. And here, I think, is where the most interesting intellectual work needs to be done, and where I think now in the United States there's actually a reasonably fertile debate bubbling up. In the town in which I live, Washington, I can assure you that the dominant view on this question is that even if America's material primacy wanes, its ideological primacy is here to stay. That is to say, the rules-based system that has been built during the West's watch is going to long outlast the West's material primacy. And that the task before us, as academics, as statesmen, as politicians, is to guide the Chinese ship of state, the Indian ship of state, the Brazilians, the Turks, the Indonesians, into the global order that we have constructed, and to ensure that they buy in to the norms that we have sought to propagate during our era of hegemony. I want to argue today that it ain't going to work that way, that it's going to be a world in which emerging powers don't want to play by our rules, and in which they want to refashion the system to advantage their own interests and their own ideological proclivities. Before I dive into some of the empirics of that argument, let me highlight two foundational principles on which I make my case. The first is that I think power and ideas in international politics are intimately intertwined. They are very difficult to separate. So if you were to ask the question, why have liberal democracy, human dignity, civil rights, capitalism, why have these ideas fared rather well over the last 200 years? Why has our system done well? Part of the answer is because we have good ideas. The world likes our ideas. When they look out there and they see the choices that are available, there is an intrinsic appeal to what we offer. I think there is something credible to the idea that the United States offers an attractive model. But the attraction of that model is also difficult to separate from American power. That is to say, that the attraction of the values that we propagate is in part a function of the fact that those values are attached to dollars and aircraft carriers. And in a world in which they are no longer attached to a dominant currency and to a dominant military, and I'm not saying that's coming around the corner, it will take a long time, those ideas will not travel as widely and enjoy the same appeal as during the period in which they are wedded to preponderant material power. The second foundational principle is a question of where do ideas and norms and ideas about how to run the world come from? And I think the dominant view, particularly among American social scientists, is that they come from a functionalist, transactionalist calculation about what works. And so if you look at what somebody like John Eikenberry or Anne-Marie Slaughter or many others write about China, they say that China is going to play by our rules because it's in their interest to do so. They are benefiting. Why would they rock the boat when they're doing so well? And my answer to that is that, well, they are playing by those rules now, but if one tries to get beneath the surface and say, might they have different rules? Our rules designed behind the Rawlsian veil of ignorance and good for everyone, or are they embedded in a particular historical path-dependent American trajectory? Our culture, our socioeconomic foundations, our history. That, to me, is a much more important determinant of the values and the norms that we propagate in the world than some sort of rationalist view about what is most functional for all countries in the global system. So, for example, if I were to say, if you were to ask me, you know, tell me about America's conception of international order, I would go back to the 19th century. I would look at the strong belief among American Protestants and Puritans that America is the new Israel, that we were going to save the world, as a foundational principle to why we have gone out and tried to save the world. That universalizing creed that zeal to go out and turn other countries into countries that look like us is uniquely American. It's not functionalist. It's not transactional. It's deeply rooted in our culture and our history. And so when I look at China or Brazil or India, I see countries that as they emerge are bringing to the fore conceptions of order deeply rooted in their own history, culture, socioeconomic foundations. So in the Chinese case, yes, they have benefited from playing by our rules. Yes, hundreds of millions of Chinese have grown out of poverty. But when they have the ability to do so, will they not want to bring to the fore Confucian principles? Will they not want to bring to the fore views about legitimacy and sovereignty and justice that are Chinese rather than taking our views? It seems to me that the answer to that question is yes. So those are those sort of two background assumptions that I bring to the analysis. One, that power and ideas are intimately wedded, and that when the power wanes, the ideas, even though they will continue to have some attraction, lose some of their punch. And the other is that the norms and the orders that great powers want to bring to the world bubble up from below. Indeed, I would go so far as to say that one of the main reasons that the last transition in global order was peaceful was because it occurred between two countries that were from, to use Peter Katzenstein's phraseology, the same civilization. And keep in mind that only one time in history has there been a change in the hegemonic order without war. And that one time was when the British gave way to the Americans and Pax Britannica ceded way for Pax Americana. But that occurred within the family. That occurred among two hegemons that were Anglo-Saxon Christian countries with very similar middle-class societies. Let me now drill down a little bit, talk briefly about what I think is unique about the West and why I think it followed a particular path-dependent trajectory, and then quickly talk about China, the Middle East, and other emerging powers and why I think they are fashioning what I would call their own brands of modernity rather than tracking the Western path of development. I think that the West's story is really, and this comes back to something I said at the very beginning, is about the strength that lay in European weakness. And that the fragmentation that characterized governance in the Holy Roman Empire actually proved to be a strength. Why? Because into the cracks in authority that existed between the three dominant traditional institutions of authority, the church, the nobility, and the monarchy, stepped a new class. And that new class was the emerging bourgeoisie of Europe that began to take root around 1000, 1100, 1200, began to fashion and open new cities outside feudal manors, began to develop nascent legal systems and banking instruments that were the forerunners for our legal professions and our financial instruments today. And those new towns and new cities, that emerging middle class, was at least in my account, my reading of the history, the vanguard of the changes that made the West the West. And in the first instance, it was that class on whose back the Protestant Reformation occurred. If there were a map here of Europe in the year 1500 or 1520 or 1550, you would see that that part of Europe that turned Protestant was largely commercial and urbanized, and that part of Europe that remained Catholic was much more heavily agrarian and rural, with one main exception being Italy, and we can talk about why that was the case. But the Protestant Reformation was really about the emancipation and autonomy of a growing middle class. Had that middle class not bought into the ideas of Luther and Zwingli and Calvin and others, the Protestant Reformation probably would have not gotten off the ground. And that growing middle class was also the foundation for the beginnings of the onset of political liberalism, because the wars of the Reformation were expensive. Monarchs needed to raise armies to fight those wars. Who had the money? The emerging bourgeoisie. And they said to the monarchs, "You want our money, you give us voice." And that was really the beginning of constitutional monarchy, the Glorious Revolution in 1688, which then spread slowly across the continent. And so I think the story of the rise of the West is about the upswing and the establishment of middle-class societies in Europe and North America, about the Protestant Reformation and the separation of political life and religious life, and about the degree to which, because we emerged as middle-class societies with economic stakeholders, we ended up with liberal democracy, secular nationalism, and industrial capitalism, rather than societies like China or Russia that were largely peasant-based or worker-based, not middle-class societies that were much more tempted by the egalitarian messages of communism. When I look at the rise of China today, I do not see a country that is tracking culturally, socioeconomically, and historically that story of the West's rise. Yes, the middle class in China is growing by leaps and bounds, but it is a very different kind of middle class than the one that we saw in Europe, in part because the Chinese state is much smarter about dealing with the middle class than the states of early modern Europe, who tried to keep the middle class down and out, which is ultimately why the growing bourgeoisie threw the monarchs under the bus. In the case of China, there was a big fight. 1978, 79, 80, number one, about the privatization of the Chinese economy, and number two, about whether businessmen could enter the Chinese Communist Party. And the workers and the peasants that dominated the party and the soldiers fought bitterly against the entry of businessmen. They lost. And ever since, party members have become businessmen, businessmen have become party members. The middle class in China is deeply in bed with the Chinese Communist Party. 40 to 45% of Chinese GDP is still produced by the state sector. Who chooses the managers of those state sectors? The Communist Party. Many of them are party members. And so if the question is the Chinese middle class going to be the vanguard of liberalization, the vanguard of the liberalization and the reform of Chinese politics in the same way that it was in Europe? My answer to that is maybe, but it's going to take a very long time. And I would keep in mind that at least 50, if not more, percent of the Chinese population is still well below the middle class, and that these kinds of transitions take a very long time. The Glorious Revolution in England occurred in 1688. How long did it take for a constitutional monarchy to become a liberal democracy? Over 200 years. It wasn't until the 1880s and the parliamentary reforms that Britain embraced what we would call liberal democracy. Prussia became a constitutional monarchy of sorts in 1848. When did Germany become a democracy? After it was defeated and occupied in World War II, with arguably a short hiatus during the Weimar period. These transitions take time. So at least from where I stand, if the question is China going to be one of the world's leading powers before it is a liberal democracy, the answer in my mind is unquestionably yes. When I look at what's happening in the Middle East, I again do not see a part of the world that is following a Western trajectory and soon to dock into the Western harbor. You may say that the Arab Spring is in fact evidence that that part of the world is breaking our way. And indeed, participatory democracy is taking root. One cannot be but uplifted by the grassroots revolutions that have been taking place beginning in Tunisia and then Egypt and in many other parts of the world. But the kind of participatory democracy that we are getting there is a very different kettle of fish than what we have seen in Europe. Largely, in my mind, well, one of the main differences has to do with the relationship between religion and politics. As I mentioned, I think one of the formative historical moments in the rise of the West was the Protestant Reformation, the separation of church and state, the belief that the sacred and the secular should occupy different realms. There has never been a Reformation in the Islamic world. There has never been conceptually a distinction between the sacred and the secular. There has never been a fight between the emperor and the pope because the caliph is both. Secular power and sacred power merged into one. And unlike Christianity, which is a law, a faith of generally a religion of faith, Islam, like Judaism, is more a religion of law. In the case of Christianity, religious leaders have temporal power only in alliance with the state, with the monarch. In the case of Islam and Judaism, civil law and religious law are one. And it's for this fundamental historical and cultural reason that, in my mind, political Islam is the main beneficiary of the Arab awakening. In every country that has had an election, Iran, Iraq, Turkey, Lebanon, Palestinian Authority, Egypt, only one exception, and that's Libya, have the political Islamic parties not won. And Libya is not a particularly uplifting case. It's interesting as well that Israel is going in the same direction. And that's because even though Israel has Western roots, many Jews in Israel came from Europe, they are trying to establish a secular liberal democracy in a country in which religion and politics are deeply intertwined. And it's safe to say that perhaps the crucial cleavage in Israeli society today is between those who are trying to defend the secular nature of the Israeli government and those who increasingly want Israeli law to be guided by Jewish law. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with this. I'm not saying that we should run from the room screaming that the Islamists are coming. I'm simply saying it's different. Their version of modernity is not going to look a lot like our version of modernity. We spent the last few decades as Americans reviling the Muslim Brotherhood and saying we would never have anything to do with them. They now control Egypt. We have no choice but to learn how to work with them. But again, it's not what we expected. It's not, in my mind, an indication of convergence towards some sort of homogenized extension of Pax Americana. Finally, let me say a couple quick things about India and Brazil, because they are already democracies. They are already secular in the sense that they are not infused with a kind of political religious zeal, although India is more complicated in the same way that the Middle East is. But even here, too, I think we are seeing countries that are finding their own paths. That is to say that even countries that are liberal democracies are not going to dock in our harbor. And in many respects, I think those people who tend to assume that you can look at a country's domestic institutions and predict its geopolitical alignments will prove to be wrong. That is to say, a country like India, a country like Brazil, will not choose its path geopolitically by saying, I want to be with the democracies. India and Brazil vote with the United States and the United Nations about 20% of the time. The rest of the time, they vote against us. India is supposedly our new strategic partner, but when you scrape beneath the surface, other than the common desire to contain China, we don't agree on Afghanistan. We don't agree on Iran. We are trying to strangle Iran. India has been dispatching one after another trade missions to Tehran to deepen commercial engagement. So I would be very wary of the assumption that if emerging countries are democracies, that they are necessarily going to do our geopolitical bidding. Let me begin to wrap up with a few thoughts on what all of this means for American foreign policy. I don't honestly know whether our leadership would agree or disagree with what I've just said. And that's because I think we still live in a country in which politicians feel that they need to talk about American exceptionalism and the durability, if not the permanence, of the American era. We heard it from Mitt Romney, and we heard it from Obama. I actually think that the politicians are getting it wrong, and that the American public, weary after the war in Afghanistan, weary after the war in Iraq, weary after the Arab awakening, is ready for a respite, is ready for a foreign policy that is less costly, less ambitious, and in which, to use Obama's terminology, we focus on nation building here at home. And so if I were to sort of identify what I see to be the most important priorities, I would identify, number one, nation building at home. That if we are going to manage this coming period in international history, and I think it's going to be a dangerous and bumpy period, we need to have our lights on. We need to have an economy that's functioning. We need to have a middle class that feels that tomorrow is better than yesterday. In other words, we need to get our own house in order if we are going to be stable enough and externally oriented enough to anchor this transition that's ahead. And I don't think there's any other country out there that can play the role that the United States can in managing this transition. Now, as I said, I don't know whether politicians in Washington get that. Many of them would see the task of managing this transition as political anathema, as defeatism. Rather than trying to get ready for a multipolar world, we should do the opposite. Read Robert Kagan's book, The World America Made. He agrees with me that after Pax Americana, we will have a bumpy time ahead of us. But his response to it is put the pedal to the metal. Increase defense spending, get in everybody's face, get behind the order that we've built, and don't let others look at us askance. In my mind, that is exactly the wrong way to go. That is the best way to precipitate the unraveling of the system. So I think the first priority is to reinvigorate, to revive our own domestic and political institutions so that we are supple enough, that we are politically and economically solvent enough to address what is going to be a difficult and bumpy period in history. The second recommendation I would offer is that I think we need to see a kind of global rebalancing of authority and responsibility. That is to say, we know that when emerging powers emerge, they want more sway. And we've already begun to give them more sway. The G8 has become the G20. Emerging powers now have more voting weight in the IMF and the World Bank. There's a debate going on about the expansion of the Security Council and the UN. I think it will probably eventually happen, even though it's politically very difficult. So that's moving forward. It's happening. But I also think we have to have a similar discussion about a rebalancing of responsibility. Emerging powers need to do more. They can't just want more influence. They have to shoulder more responsibility. And I think that means getting more buy-in, more activism from the Brazils, Indias, Turkeys of the world. I think it would be great if Turkey and Egypt collectively stepped up and did something in Syria. Right? If we are moving into a world in which the United States is going to say, hey, it's time for a rest, we need others to be able to face challenges. And it looks to me in Syria that neither the United States nor Europe wants to touch the country with a 10-foot pole. Well, if we're not going to do it, who is going to do it? If Uncle Sam is not going to send out the fire trucks every time there's a problem, who is going to do it? Well, the answer, hopefully, is that we start encouraging others to do more. And I think we're already at the cusp of that world in which we can no longer rely on the United States to be the defender and lender of last resort. Right? And I would point out that our most significant partner in the world for the last 200 years, Europe, has spent the last 3-4 years on the edge of meltdown, flirting with disaster. And we have done nothing. We have sent Lael Brainard or Tim Geithner to Europe. They meet with Chancellor Merkel. They meet with Mario Draghi. They meet with Mr. Monti. They kiss, and they get back on their planes. That's a new world, because it used to be that when a country or countries were in a major financial crisis, we would get out our checkbook. We can't get out our checkbook now because we are in debt up to our eyeballs. But that is just, I think, a little window into the nature of this new world in which we are no longer going to get up and rush in every time there's trouble. One additional thought on that is I think that it would be useful for the United States to invest in regionalism elsewhere. That is to say, I think we're heading into a world in which the gap between the demand for global governance and the supply of global governance is going to get bigger and bigger by the day. And if I had to guess what institutions are actually going to start to fill that gap, it's not going to be the big global ones. It's not going to be the UN or the Kyoto Protocol, which is already falling short. My guess is it's going to be regional. ASEAN, the Gulf Cooperation Council, Mercosur and UNASUR. And that's because if we're heading into a world in which there is no longer a guardian of last resort, then it may well be that guardianship and the provision of public goods drop down one level to regional hegemons and regional actors. So I think we should be investing heavily in that regional infrastructure under the assumption that it's the second best option for delivering public goods, if in fact I'm right that they will not be delivered at the global level. Final point. As I said, I'm quite skeptical that the rest of the world is going to sign in and on to our order. But I think that the bottom line for where we want to end up in 2050 is that we need to ensure that when this rules-based system degrades, it gives way to another rules-based system. In some way, that's the magic of Pax Britannica and Pax Americana, that we have lived in a world governed by rules. They've been our rules, We've been very lucky to have been able to write those rules. We wrote them to benefit us. But now that that era of hegemony is slipping, we have to be ready to give ground and fashion a new set of rules with countries that will bring to the fore different civilizational, historical, cultural norms and rules. And I think if we negotiate, if we show flexibility, if we give some and take some, we may well be able to get from here to there. That is to say, end up in a rules-based order. But if we think that they're going to be our rules, we're definitely going to get it wrong. If we have the foresight and the courage to sit down with emerging powers and try to create a new set of rules, some of which are theirs and some of which are ours, then it may well be that this global turn, this period in which the global center of gravity shifts quite dramatically and profoundly, could coincide with one of the longest periods of peace in history. We will wait and see. Thank you.
Professor Kupchan has agreed to take questions, and so I invite you to fire away from all sides. I would also, I neglected to say at the outset that we have books for sale, and you could read the fuller version, I guess it's fair to say, of this talk, and purchase books at a very good price after we finish. But please, the floor is open.
Peter.
Charlie, as you know, I very much agree with the basic thesis of the book and of the lecture. But I was playing around saying, what would happen if this lecture had been given in Beijing? And I say, in fact, I would say this is a lecture marked by Occidentalism, a very differentiated understanding of the East, but a very unitary conception of the West in your macro-historical scale. So my first question is, when you invoke the we of the West and paint it all in one color, the liberal middle class rising gradually for 800 years, what would happen if you took the same nuance which you had to apply to the East and apply it to the West? Would the moment of transition be as stark and scary? And the second question I have, which was at the end of your talk, I very much agree that the regional order is, you know, not something we invest in. It is something which has been going on for about 50 or 60 years. Now, if this is a process of regionalization which has been going on, maybe we want to manage it, but I doubt it. It is the natural international order where no one is in charge. So why do you see that this regionalism may be something for the future when I see it as a very pervasive part of certainly the last 30 to 50 years?
Shall I just take them one by one?
Yes, please.
Okay. Yeah, I obviously oversimplified in talking about the West as the West in the sense that one can parse it into many different kinds of polities. In talking about the Protestant Reformation as the beginning of the secularization of politics, that's obviously wrong, number one, because it took hundreds of years for secularity to manifest itself in Europe. And number two, in many European countries today, you still have state churches, right? The Queen of England, after all, is the head of the Anglican Church. So there are obviously quite significant differences within what I was calling the West. However, I do think that there is a cultural and historical commonality. I do think that it is not inappropriate to talk about the European and North American democracies as a community, as a polity of sorts. And I think that my own belief in that community has strengthened over the course of the last 20 years. And that's because I would not have expected the West to hang together as durably as it has done since the demise of the Soviet Union. If we had been sitting in this hall in let's say, 1993, 1994, I don't think any of us would have predicted that NATO would be wrapping up a 10-year mission in Afghanistan, having recently toppled Muammar Gaddafi from power. So the evidence that there is a stickiness, a cohesiveness to a Western political community, I think that fortifies my own comfort in talking about the West as a collective entity. And I also think that despite the differences between Pax Britannica and Pax Americana, there's more similarity than there is contrast when you sort of look at the level of norms. So I don't in any way want to minimize the differences, but I also think that it is intellectually defensible to treat the West and its combined era of hegemony as a particular kind of political formation. I don't disagree with you about regionalism in the sense that it has been developing and picking up steam, and there have been significant advances in regional bodies and regional integration right through the period of Pax Americana. I think that my comments were meant to be more prescriptive. That is to say that I would be investing heavily in, take the African Union. I would be giving them institutional capacity. I would be giving them training. Because as we've just seen in Mali, right, Africans were supposed to go in and do the work, but who went in? The French. Are the Africans going to be able to take over from the French? I don't know. But it seems to me that if I'm right and you know, we will increasingly not be showing up at the party, then I think it's important to have regional bodies at the ready to show up at the party. Are we the decisive actor in making that happen? No. But as a goal of American foreign policy, I would at this point put it high on my list. Please.
Stretches of time that it chooses as its points of transition, if you will, and how that choice influences some of the conclusions that you draw. For example, that periodization probably would not have been a viable one, or would not have come up in the context of the Cold War, because with this kind of periodization, you can write the Soviet Union out of history as irrelevant because it came and it went. But from the perspective of 25 years ago, you couldn't write the Soviet Union out of history. As a matter of fact, it would play a central role. And if you choose a different periodization again, then 25 years ago, you would be in a position where Japan would look a lot then like China looks today. And so in terms of the impact that it had, or the presumed impact it would have on the future of a global economy and a global game, if you will. And so I was wondering whether the periodizations that we choose influence some of what we see in the future, and what an alternative periodization, if you were to pick one, would produce in terms of a different prediction of the future. And by an alternative periodization, I mean even one where that shifted away from Anglo-American influence and towards even French influence. One of the things that you mentioned about how ideas don't travel without power, I think there's an interesting kind of partial, at least, exception to that, and that's the ideas of the French Revolution, even after France stopped being in a powerful state, which was relatively quickly after the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. The ideas that were put forward in the French Revolution had enormous power. And so what if you don't take an Anglo-centric but a Franco-centric view of history? How does it look in terms of the capacity of ideas to operate in the absence of power, for example? My other question is about, you were speaking of the long view and you were offering some prescriptive perspectives on, you know, what we should be doing. I didn't have a clear sense, however, of what you thought was the ideal outcome. I was just wondering if you could talk about, in an ideal world, you know, what is it that we're aiming towards by doing these things? I have a rough sense based on some of the prescriptions that you offered, but I was wondering if you could offer something.
Charles, this is one of the historians who said that you said would keep you on your toes.
I could tell by the nature of the question. I mean, the whole, you know, periodization question is very interesting, and obviously, had I chosen different markers, I think I would have, you know, come up with a different narrative, a different story of the last couple hundred years, and certainly the Cold War. And you're right to point out that it's easy to talk about Pax Americana and American hegemony now that the Soviet Union has disappeared. We would not have talked that way were we here in the heat of the Cold War in the 1980s. That having been said, I do think that there was a, you know, that 1815 is an important historical breakpoint, because it marks the beginnings of the long period in which Europe was sufficiently at peace to allow its major players to focus on the rest of the world. And it was that peaceful period and the implementation of the Concert of Europe and splendid isolation that allowed the British to basically deploy almost all of the Royal Navy on overseas station. And so that, to me, is really the European strategy and the imperial strategy are hand in hand, and I see it as what made possible Pax Britannica. I'm not, when you say periodization, you know, I sort of mark it from 1815 to 1914. You're saying that's too long?
No, I think, but you're suggesting that it continues to more or less the present, right, because it's ending.
No, I stop it in 1914, and then we have two decades in which all hell breaks loose because there's no one at the helm. And then I date the onset of Pax Americana as the bombing of Pearl Harbor, when the United States was finally convinced to step into the vacuum that had been left by the British. And when the dollar starts coming forcefully online to replace pound sterling as the global reserve currency. Just two other quick comments. I don't at all disagree with you about power and ideas. I mean, I think that ideas matter hugely in international politics and in history, but I also am wary of treating them in a way that is completely independent of power. That is to say, I think that you know, ideas, even good ideas, travel best when they are propagated by powerful actors, and that ideational shifting points and nodal points in history occur in part because there are material incentives for politicians to embrace those ideas. And so I guess that, in the end of the day, makes me more of a materialist than an ideationalist, but sort of that's my view of politics. And then in the ideal outcome would, in my mind, be our ability to get to a world that is truly multipolar without major war, and in which that endpoint, whether it's 2050 or 2060, rests upon a new rules-based system, maybe much more regionalized than the one that we've been living in, that is to say, in which there is a devolution of authority and responsibility to regional actors and regional bodies, but in which generally the main parts of the world are playing by certain set of international rules and resolving disputes peacefully. Please.
In the world post Pax Americana that you describe, it sounds like it's no one state's world. But I'm wondering if you can comment on the rise of perhaps other non-state actors that might co-opt with states in that arrangement, particularly as we think about the blurring of the distinction between public and private goods, and particularly as we challenge our notion of war and military engagement, that's terrorism insurgency. Mm-hmm. So,
you know, for starters, I would say that I think that the nation state is alive and well and making a comeback. And that globalization paradoxically has strengthened sovereignty. And that's because it has pissed off electorates. And that makes their leaders dig in. You know, one book that I find particularly instructive about where we are today, even though it was written about a very different period, is Karl Polanyi's book, The Great Transformation, right, where he writes about the states that tether themselves to the gold standard. And then, because of fluctuations in international financial markets and commerce, they feel whipsawed, completely out of control. And then they wake up and they scream, we're madder than hell, we're not going to take it anymore. And what do you get? You get fascism and nasty, angry states. I don't think we're there yet, but I do think that particularly in countries that were supposed to be at the forefront of post-sovereignty, i.e. European countries and our countries, globalization has been sufficiently painful and led to a sufficient loss of control over destiny that I think states are fighting back. So I do not see the 21st century as a century in which the nation state withers away. I think it is one in which it will continue to be defined by nation states. That having been said, I think you're right that we've now got a whole host of non-state actors, whether they're in the form of militant networks or commercial networks or social movements or class-based movements of a sort that we haven't seen before. And you know, I don't know what that means, to be quite honest with you. I worry that we're sort of, as I said, we're living through this period in which we need governance to deal with those sorts of things, to deal with capital flows, to deal with social movements, to deal with climate change, to deal with nuclear proliferation. We're not getting that governance, right? Our government, our national government, is effectively non-functional, right? And so if it's non-functional here, how could it possibly be functional in terms of delivering global goods? And so right now, I think we're in a period in which our polities are befuddled, in which there has been a profound change in the socioeconomic foundations of our societies. I mean, I think that globalization has rocked our middle classes in ways they have never been rocked. I don't know what ordinary Americans are going to do in 2025, right? And that's because I think many of the manufacturing jobs they used to do have gone for good. They're gone. They're not coming back. So I think we need to figure out what's next, and the Europeans need to figure that out. The Germans have actually figured it out, but they have a very different kind of industrial infrastructure than most other advanced industrial democracies. I haven't really answered your question, but I think it adds to this question of how are our societies going to get their mojo back. All the way in the back.
I saw your point about the role of regional bodies and actors as perhaps inconsistent with some of the arguments you were making earlier. You seem to suggest or seem to imply that these regional bodies will act according to some set of international rules and norms, which are drawn from Anglo-Saxon experience in this Pax Americana era. But it seems to me that if the other point of your argument is correct, that you'll see states and civilizations start to reshape norms and rules according to their own civilizational values, social, political histories, regional bodies is where you'd expect to see it move first. And I mention that specifically in the context of the GCC. The GCC has now become a club of monarchies. They've invited Jordan and redefined what the Gulf is by inviting Morocco to join, right? You advocate these regional bodies stepping up to the plate, picking up the slack. They're going to do that according to local interests and local, perhaps, cultural disputes. And the GCC is another good example of that. They stepped up to the plate and gave the Sultan of Oman $10 billion to buy off dissent, and then when they couldn't give enough money to the Bahraini emir, they sent in Saudi troops with a couple Emiratis accompanying them and intervened. Suggesting that the African Union should step up in Mali, the analogy in the Middle East would be the GCC stepping up into Syria. There's already a widespread perception that there's a new Middle Eastern Cold War between Saudi Arabia and Iran being fought by proxies in weak states. That's what would happen if the GCC stepped up the way you're advocating we should encourage them to.
Well, I didn't mean to suggest that I thought that if we strengthened regional bodies, or if those regional bodies strengthen on their own, that they would play our game. I don't think they will, nor do I want them to. What I want them to do is to be functional. And so for many American diplomats, they would be uncomfortable with the idea that there is a regional organization in the Gulf that is a club of autocratic monarchs, right? For me, that's fine. That's what they want to do. That's the nature of the polities that exist in the Arabian Peninsula. As long as they are kind of dealing with public bads, then that's the kind of regional organization that I think we would want to work with. Now, that doesn't mean that I think the United States should just, you know, cast aside its concerns about human rights and cast aside its concerns about democracy. But we do need to understand that those regional bodies are going to be playing by their own rules. And I'm completely comfortable with that, and I think that's the way it should go. And we've already had an example of what you're talking about, which is when GCC countries sent troops into Bahrain, right, to clamp down on the Shiite uprising. And so you could say that that's what we're going to get, but so be it. I think you should be able to ask a question.
I think so, too.
Okay.
So I want to come back to, I guess it's in a way connected to this idea, to the question of the ideal solution, but it also goes back to something you suggested early on. You graciously said that you're not sure whether politicians are in a position in today's Washington to talk about a period of relative decline and to adjusting to that relative decline. It seems to me this is a very large question. And it's not just about politicians. It's not just about presidents and presidential candidates. It seems to me that even in the foreign policy bureaucracy, the range of acceptable discourse, if you will, mm-hmm. is a remarkably narrow one, or at least it has been, running from, you know, hawkish neoconservatism on one end to liberal internationalism mm-hmm. on the other. And so it seems to me that it's very difficult for me to imagine, and you seem to allude to acknowledge this yourself, people in Washington, the people you associate with, and you were part of the NSC at one point, accepting this. And so my question is, if I could just ask you to pursue this a little bit. What's the arguments that one makes to get them to acknowledge something that I agree with in terms of what you're saying needs to happen? It seems to me one could be cynical and suggest that we're very far from that place.
Yeah, I mean, I would distinguish between kind of two different dimensions of the issue. There's the political dimension, and there I think the question is that politicians remain fearful of uttering the word decline. And in fact, when I've engaged in these kinds of discussions in Washington, I actually don't use the word decline, because it now carries so much baggage that if it enters the conversation, the politicians run from the room or they start sweating. And so part of it is using a different narrative, is talking about adjusting to a changing world, right? Shifting, rebalancing American priorities. They can handle that. Just don't get into this decline thing. That's different than what you get in the foreign policy bureaucracy elite talk shops, where they're not so much worried about the decline thing. I've given this kind of talk in the State Department, and they just look at me like I'm nuts. I mean, literally, they think that it's completely in outer space, because they still live in this world where American diplomats are at the center of everything and pull all the strings. And so they honestly believe that this kind of order is still alive and well. And then I would say there's this sort of the third camp, and that would be the more intellectual camp, the kind of John Eikenberry, if you've read him, and that there in the sort of, you know, American order was designed behind the Rawlsian veil of ignorance. This is an order that everybody can love and dismiss arguments that about bubbling up from below. I think that we are getting to a point politically where this conversation will happen. I have had conversations with some members of Congress who have said that when they go back to their constituencies, their voters are ready to talk about this stuff. More ready than congressmen think they are. But I'm not quite sure that the political class is really ready for that, and I don't think they've developed the language that they're comfortable with. But I do think that the way to get at it is through the back door, which is what Obama's been doing, and that's nation building at home.
I mean, in some ways, the most interesting part of this is the difficulty you have in making your argument resonate with the second group. It's interesting to me that very smart people who make up the bureaucracy are looking at you in the way that they're looking at you, because they don't have those political pressures. That interests me.
Yeah. But although I would point out that the conversation in Washington has changed in one dramatic way, and that is that before the financial crisis and the Iraq war, there was no room even for a debate about the material side of this equation. That is to say that nobody questioned that the 21st century would be an American century. Now there is widespread acceptance that the material side of things has changed. And that now means that the focus of the debate ends up being on the normative side of the house rather than on the material side. Please.
Thanks for the talk. In September 2010, you wrote a piece entitled Palestinians Should Just Say Yes. Since the events of December of 10, do you still hold those same views? And also in an article you mentioned Israel holds all of the cards. But what about the demographic card as far as the Arab population in Israel proper being 20% and far outpacing the Jewish population growth rate.
This is one of the dangers of the internet. You write something and 2 years later someone's actually read it. I would stand by that that advice to the Palestinian Authority to just say yes, because number one, I don't think they have much alternative. Number two, it would seem to me to be the best negotiating strategy with an Israeli government that is very comfortable kicking the can down the road. Right, and I think the Palestinians have attempted to do something to get the debate going, and the most recent move was at the United Nations, but I don't know that has kind of won them enough international support to make much of a difference. And so it seems to me if the Palestinians sort of recognized that there won't be a right of return, right, that other issues having to do with borders and a division of Jerusalem and basically kind of accepted what's on the table, then it puts enormous onus on the Israelis.
But don't they have overwhelming world support as far as their position? I mean, how many countries are really in favor of the Israeli position?
Well, I'm not sure how much that matters.
I mean, you were mentioning, you know, support.
Right? What you know, in the end of the day, what you need to do is you need to build a governing coalition in Israel that is ready to make a deal. And if you had Palestinians who said to the Israelis, "We are ready to sign, show us the piece of paper, we're ready to go," it puts a great deal of pressure on the Israelis to do something. Right now, they can say, "We don't have a partner." And they don't have a partner.
Well, shouldn't they just hold out? Is it more in their interest as far as the population growth within Israel proper versus the Jewish growth? I mean, just by the numbers, wouldn't they win in the end in the long run?
My guess is what you would end up with in the long run is what you have now. That is to say, a large Palestinian population living in a West Bank largely controlled by Israel.
But within Israel proper, within the 49 armistice line, you would have a majority ostensibly, and then they would win by democratic processes. And if they didn't win, then the global pressure as far as, you know, an apartheid system would bear down on them greatly. And it's already, I think, happening.
You know, I think that the longer it goes on, the worse it is for all concerned. And so I wrote that piece as a way of saying, is there some way to break this logjam sooner rather than later? And one way to do that is to create a situation in which Israelis look across the border and they say, there is a partner that we can trust and that's ready to make peace. Please.
You may know that Kishore Mahbubani was here last week, and from what I've heard and read of him, he seems to be, you know, in realistic outer space with you. If you're familiar with his work, could you comment on the differences between your perspectives, just in general, and his? They seem to be very different.
I haven't read Kishore's newest book. I understand he has a new one that just came out, and that book, from what I gather, is more about a global convergence. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. That was the subject of his lecture.
Okay. My reading of his previous books was that, you know, he's overly bullish on Asia, right? That he sees Asia as really being the next center of global politics. And I'm bullish on Asia, but I don't see an Asia that is really going to kind of be the center of global politics. As I said, I think it will be a broadly diffused and diversified international system. He is also more critical of the United States than I am. I don't know whether that came across in his talk or not, but he sometimes is a little bit, I think, too critical of the United States for my taste, although our country certainly deserves its criticism from time to time. What exactly was in this new book I can't comment on because I haven't read it yet. Yes? I mean, I think that there is some level of convergence. I don't want to suggest that globalization hasn't led to a narrowing of the ideological amplitude. I mean, to some extent, we're all capitalists now. We don't have these huge debates of the sort that we had in the 20th century about foundational principles of our markets. But I do think, when I look at a country like China, I think it will bring to the fore a very different approach to international governance than the one that either the British or the Americans have been embracing. China is, in my mind, a much more ethnocentric country. I don't think China really wants to go out and change the world in the way that the United States has. And in that respect, it's going to be a very different kind of major power. I think it wants to go into Latin America and Africa and buy land and have soybeans and get oil and have secure access to energy supplies. But do they really want to go out and cynicize the rest of the world? No. Right? And that's, I think, very consistent with Chinese history. And one reason that the world that I think we're heading toward is one in which there is much more regional differentiation and much more pluralism and much more diversity at the normative level and at the cultural level than I think many Americans were betting on when Pax Americana was in its upward trajectory.
You mentioned several trends that are happening as we speak in the recent past. Current administration contributing significantly to a non-governance, our debt problems. We need to nation build at home. I'm curious as to how the world sees us, given the fact that we have an administration who has proven itself very ineffective at governing here at home. As that projects outward, how are we viewed in the Middle East? How are we viewed by China? It seems like we're being challenged on a much more regular and frequent basis because, I don't want to be hawkish, but they being our foreign opponents, don't seem to fear American position. And we have an administration who leads from behind and does not, transforming America appears to equate that we are not going to project our national security interests. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're right that in Asia, and in the Middle East, there are questions about America's staying power. There are questions about American governance and the health of the American economy. Those questions are not grave enough that countries are backing away from us or betting against us. But you do hear, when you talk to people from those countries or travel in those regions, you do hear a level of questioning that is new. And I don't think is unjustified. I think it's justified because I think we as a nation are going through a period of strategic retrenchment that will be felt around the world. And so it's good that countries are accurately perceiving that this is a phase the country's going through. I think that the trick for Obama or whoever comes after him is to find the middle ground between retrenchment, rebuilding at home, and doing too little. I think that part of the problem is that, I was not a fan of the war in Iraq or trying to turn Afghanistan into Ohio. I think both of those tasks were a bridge too far. And to some extent, it has soured us on internationalism in a way that is somewhat erroneous, because they were the wrong wars. And now we may skip some things that we should do because of reaction to those unnecessary engagements that didn't go very well. And so what I hope that the president is able to do is to kind of thread that needle, to get us back to a level of engagement in the world that is smarter, that's less costly, but is nonetheless sufficient to kind of keep partners from saying, hey, Uncle Sam has cut and run. We definitely don't want that. I think Obama, I'd probably give him somewhat higher marks than you in finding that middle ground. That is to say, I think he's done a good job of getting out of Iraq and putting a cap on the mission in Afghanistan, while at the same time saying to China, we're here. We are rebalancing our forces. And at the same time saying to the Iranians, don't try to get a nuclear weapon. So I'd say he's doing a pretty good job of finding that balance.
It seems wrong not to give Cornell International Affairs Review a chance right at the very end. Lucius, I saw that you had your hand up. A quick question, if you would, please.
You referred to the idea of there not being a political discourse about the decline of America, and about that being like an abhorrent word. And I was wondering what you thought, given the last challenge to US hegemony being 9/11, and that leading to a 10-year war, which, as you say, is just ending now, do you think that your recommendation that the US will focus on nation building is really, given the shock which China's surpassing of America will have in an economic sense, do you think that the shock of that psychologically will be so great that the sort of movement away from foreign policy to focus on domestic policy is realistic?
You mean that we will be so shocked by the rise of China that we focus abroad, that we get riled up?
The U.S. won't be able to focus solely on itself. I.e., it will just. You said that every other previous transition of a superpower has come with war, with the exception of the
Anglo-American.
And I'm not suggesting that America will go to war with China, but perhaps that they would resort to trade sanctions or something like that against China.
Yeah, that era of direct confrontation between China and the United States, if it is to happen, is probably far off, i.e. the next decade, not this decade. But I do think that for the next while, and by that I mean the balance of this decade, American politicians are going to be focusing at home. And I think that, you know, Obama was reelected on that mandate. Iran is the one fly in the ointment where I can foresee, you know, a major military conflict during Obama's second term. I think other than Iran, he is not going to be picking any fights. And I also think that, you know, Obama and other politicians can and should make the argument that getting ready for this period in history, getting ready for the rise of China, requires domestic renewal, right? That our strength starts at home, that we need to rebuild our infrastructure, our schools, our research and development, if we're going to be able to hold our own in a world in which you have all these rising powers coming up. So yes, China will keep us engaged, and it's already doing that. But I do also think we're passing through an inflection point in the domestic sources of American internationalism, moving into a period of greater flux that we've seen in a long time. I thought it was quite remarkable that in the campaign, Romney effectively backed off on most foreign policy issues and didn't go to the mat on Afghanistan, didn't call for keeping U.S. troops. And why has that happened? Because he went out on his listening tours and his focus groups, and even Republican voters have said, it's enough already. Right? And we are probably on the cusp of the implementation of sequestration. And under the best of circumstances, our defense spending is going to get whacked in the next few years. And that's going to have an impact on our foreign policy.
One of the things that I most want with this speaker series is to have distinguished guests come in who can talk in big terms about international affairs, about the human condition, and about what we need to be doing, in this case, obviously, as Americans. I think that our guest today, Professor Kupchan, has more than fulfilled that desire on my part. I think it's been a very stimulating discussion. I do want to again remind you of books that are available at the front. I want to thank you all for coming, and finally ask you to join me in thanking our guest.
Thank you. Thank you very much.